Moving to 1964, we once more go to Mike Hodel's documentary and his colorful narrative.
The obvious metaphor, the only metaphor, for the 1964 Democratic Convention is the cattle drive, with Lyndon Johnson firmly in the saddle, riding herd on the delegates, the platform, getting his political steers to market without losing any to raiders or rustlers or sickness, heading off any attempt to deviate from the trail, choosing an old partner to ride drag to bring up the rear without choking on the dust. The herd gathers peacefully enough in Atlantic City, moves without incident into the pens, goes through the political branding process, and is turned loose. The trail boss confident that they will make their own way to the proper political pen. Johnson is in the saddle because John F. Kennedy has been assassinated. The man who spoke of Camelot is succeeded by the man who uses earthier metaphors, who brings his Western drawl to the place where the Eastern accents once were king. And along the way, Johnson has cut out the mavericks in the herd, those with the Harvard twangs, those with the sophistication he lacks. But if John Kennedy is dead, his memory, his tradition lives. It lives not only in the minds of the delegates, but in the person of Robert Kennedy, still Attorney General of the United States, and one of the men Lyndon Johnson could neither rope nor brand. And Robert Kennedy keeps his brother John alive, using words from Romeo and Juliet. When he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night. Lyndon Johnson also invokes John Kennedy's memory, but his words have a pragmatic political purpose.
4 years ago, one of our greatest Americans stood before this Democratic Convention, John F. Kennedy of the state of Massachusetts. We grieved at his loss, but we carried on, and we have fulfilled his program without flinching for one moment. In the last 3 days, the noble Democrats who are delegates to this convention have made a great start toward a great Democratic victory. You have built a platform on which I am proud to stand.
That done, Johnson picks up the reins again, checks his gun for cleanliness, and rides out with his new partner, headed after the Republican outlaws, the man from Arizona, Barry Goldwater, and his sidekick from New York, William Miller. In November, Lyndon Johnson of Texas will nail their hides to the barn door.
But the cattle drive does not sum up the convention entirely. In 1964, members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, after not being allowed to attend a local precinct meeting of the Democratic Party, formed the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. At the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenged the delegates for not addressing the concerns of the blacks in Mississippi. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was given a chance to speak in front of the Credentials Committee. One of the people to speak on behalf of the party was the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you value your party, if you value your nation, if you value the future of democratic government, you have no alternative but to recognize with full voice and vote the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Recognition of the Freedom Democratic Party would say to them that somewhere in this world, that is a nation that cares about justice, that lives in democracy, and that ensures the rights of the downtrodden.
The Credentials Committee meeting was to be televised until President Johnson held a last-minute press conference at the exact same time. Many felt the move was to keep the public from hearing any negative comments about the party. But the move backfired because the press still covered the event and was able to broadcast highlights on the evening news. One of the people who stood out that evening was a 45-year-old black woman sharecropper. It was her incredibly powerful personal story which moved many. Fannie Lou Hamer overcame enormous obstacles and two failed attempts at getting her voter registration card. But she finally got it and became an organizer in the civil rights movement and worked to register other blacks in Mississippi to vote. It was on the return trip from one of these clinics that Fannie Lou Hamer was beaten by two black prisoners who were forced to do so by Winona, Mississippi police. This is Fannie Lou Hamer describing the events of that day. She begins by quoting one of the white police officers.
"We gonna make you wish you was dead." And they led me out of that cell into another cell. And he gave a Negro prisoner a blackjack. And he ordered me to lay down on a bunk bed. And a Negro prisoner said, "Do you want me to beat her with this, sir?" And he said, "You're damn right. Because if you don't, you know what I'll do for you." And I laid down on the bunk like he ordered me to do. And the first Negro beat me. He beat me until he was exhausted. And after he beat, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And during the time he was beating, I began to work my feet because that was a horrible experience. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro that had beat to sit on my feet while the second one beat, and I just began to scream where I couldn't control it. And then the white man got up and began to beat me in my head. I have a blood clot now, and the artery to the left eye, and a permanent kidney injury on the right side from that beating. These are the things that we go through in the state of Mississippi, just trying to be treated like a human being. But still, this is called a part of America.
The white police officers involved in her beating were acquitted by an all-white jury. This injustice made Fannie Lou Hamer even more determined to fight for equal rights in Mississippi. After the convention, Malcolm X spoke to a group in Harlem, New York, about Mississippi and the convention in Atlantic City.
"So what happens in Mississippi in the South has a direct bearing on what happens to you and me here in Harlem. And likewise, out of the Democratic Party, which black people supported, recently, I think something like 97%, all of these crackers, and that's what they are, crackers, they belong to the Democratic Party. That's the party they belong to.
Same one you belong to. Same one you support. Same one you say is going to get you this and get you that. Why, the base of the Democratic Party is in the South. It's the foundation of its authority is in the South. The head of the Democratic Party is sitting in the White House. He could have gotten Mrs. Hamer in Atlantic City. He could have opened up his mouth and had her seated. Hubert Humphrey could have opened his mouth and had her seated. Wagner, the mayor right here, could have opened up his mouth and used his weight and had her seated. Don't be talking about some crackers down in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia. All of them are playing the same game. Lyndon B. Johnson is the head of the cracker party. Now, I don't want to be stepping on toes or saying things that you didn't think I was going to say. But don't ever, ever, ever call me up here to talk about Mississippi. It's controlled right up here from the north. Mississippi is controlled from the north. Alabama is controlled from the north. These northern crackers are in cahoots with the southern crackers. Only these northern crackers smile in your face and show you their teeth. And they stick the knife in your back when you turn around. You at least know what that man down there is doing, and you know how to deal with him. So all I say is this. This is all I say. That when you start talking about one,
talk about the other. When you start worrying about the part or the piece, worry about the whole. And if this piece is no good, the entire pie is no good, because it all comes out of the same plate and it's made up out of the same ingredients. Wagner is a Democrat. He belongs to the same party as Eastman. Johnson is a Democrat. He belongs to the same party as Eastman. Now, Wagner was in Atlantic City. Ray Jones was in Atlantic City. Lyndon B. Johnson was in Atlantic City. Hubert Humphrey was in Atlantic City. The crackers that you voted for were in Atlantic City. What did they do for you when you wanted to sit down? They were quiet. They were silent. They said, don't rock the boat. You might get Goldwater elected.
Once again, Mike Hodel.
There are two Democratic Party conventions in Chicago in August of 1968. One is inside the International Amphitheater with banners and placards and gavels and speeches. The other is in the streets and parks of Mayor Richard Daley's city with tear gas and rocks and mace and clubs, and most of all, with blood. And a cloud marked Vietnam hangs over both, tangling them together. Separate the strands. Go back to a snowy winter in New Hampshire, when a northern senator named Eugene McCarthy tramps the streets, braves the cold, and challenges a president.
In which I challenge a Democratic president. I challenge a particular policy in Vietnam.
Move forward to a spring day when another senator, this one named Kennedy, announces he too will seek to take the nomination from the president.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
Come forward a bit more when that president tells the nation he will not seek re-election.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Go to Los Angeles, where one man wins an election and loses his life.
Hold out! Back out! Give him room!
Yeah, there's a pool of blood on the ground, naturally. I think he was shot in the head.
With that chronicled, come to Chicago in August of 1968. Come as a delegate with the proper credentials to get you past the police, into the amphitheater, into the hotel suites and the delegations. Hear the talk of Eugene McCarthy, the name of Edward Moore Kennedy, the politics of joy of Hubert Humphrey. Feel the unseen presence of Lyndon Johnson. Or come to what they are calling the Festival of Life, the street theater, the anti-war demonstrations, the hippies, the yippies. Into the park, smell the incense, the marijuana, hear the music, hear the speeches, hear the laughter. Inside or outside, take your choice. Some of the delegates inside take offense at Chicago Mayor Richard Daley's tactics both inside the amphitheater and outside in the streets. Daley, himself a delegate, uses tactics inside the hall that are reminiscent of what his police are using outside. When the delegates protest, Mayor Daley tries to adjourn the convention, and the protest grows.
Will the convention be in order? Will the sergeant at arms enforce order in the convention? Oh. Will the convention be in order? Will the convention be in order? Because may the chairman make a brief statement. May I make a brief statement? It is not in order to make a general motion to adjourn, because that would kill the convention. The chair would gladly recognize the distinguished mayor of the city of Chicago to adjourn to a time certain, such as 12 o'clock tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn to 12 o'clock tomorrow.
The question is on the motion. So many as in favor will vote aye.
Aye!
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. Accordingly, the House stands adjourned until 12 o'clock noon tomorrow.
Convention Chairman Carl Albert. Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon describes the major conflict in the platform on Vietnam.
Issues whether or not the Democratic Convention is going to vote today to continue to kill American boys in South Vietnam. We can't possibly justify this killing of our boys. We've got to have a change in policy, and I hope the Democratic Party will take advantage of the opportunity to unite the party, and they'll never unite this party unless they change the policy in Vietnam.
But the convention refuses to heed Morse's words. It votes a plank supporting President Johnson's Vietnam War policies.
Good evening. This is Pacifica Radio, Chicago.
In a perfectly clear example of the differences between the events inside the convention in Chicago and those outside, this coverage from within the convention hall, hosted by Pacifica reporters Steve Bookchester and Dale Miner, shows that even on a supposedly eventful day, the pace is slow and the excitement minimal. But out on the streets, Pacifica reporters were in their element, covering the quickly changing action, the fiery speeches, and the violence. Throughout the 1960s, in Pacifica radio, one name seemed to always be connected to the biggest events of that decade, Elsa Knight Thompson. True to form, she produced an award-winning documentary called A Night in Chicago about the events outside the convention that summer in 1968. This recording is universally acknowledged as one of the most quintessential Pacifica programs in the archives collection.
Early yesterday evening, a marching line of demonstrators, two blocks long, 25 abreast, attempted to get down LaSalle Street to Grant Park, opposite the Democratic headquarters in the Conrad Hilton. After attending a Black Panther rally, at which Bobby Seale, national chairman of the Panthers, spoke.
Revolution in this country that's occurring is in fact people coming forth to demand freedom. Now, just a second. There's a lesson that Minister of Defense UEP Duke teaches, that whenever the people disagree with the political decisions that's been made upon their heads, that whenever the people disagree with those political decisions, the racist power structure sends in guns and force to see that the people accept those political decisions. But we are here as revolutionaries to let them know that we refuse to accept those political decisions that maintain the oppression of our black people and other people in the world.
But in Lincoln Park, the police moved in force and under circumstances requiring some explanation.
Some of the demonstrators ran back into the park with a few sticks. The police are now moving across in a rank, shooting tear gas. Some of the kids are ripping off leaves. They're holding their faces. You can see the tear gas in the air. They have large fire trucks with lights. The gas is around. My eyes are beginning to burn a little bit. I'm going to walk over. The police are walking forward with rifles and clubs out. They are moving over with gas masks. The area is completely lighted up. There's trucks with multiple lights on it. They have shot off tear gas. As I mentioned earlier, Allen Ginsberg and John Lindsay came around at my feet just now, it seems, was a tear gas or some kind of instrument. There's now a line of police in helmets. The light truck has been brought forward. There are a few brave photographers and others in the middle. I am now in line between the demonstrators on one side. I'm going to get out of the way a little bit as a few of the demonstrators are throwing rocks, etc. I had to quickly retreat as someone began to throw a few cans. I want to get close enough so they can see that it's Pacifica Radio here. and not police radio, you can begin to now feel the gas. They're moving back slowly. I don't know where we are in the park. There are no street signs. The truck is now spraying. The truck is spraying a gas. The kids are now moving back into the street, and for the first time, this reporter can feel whatsoever it is that's there. They're fighting and pushing and shoving. I'm trying to get far enough back so I can see what's happening, but it's almost impossible to be able to give you a report as my eyes against the burn. Bill Watson here, and I'm going to have to...
Pacifica reporter Bill Watson, Inside Lincoln Park, Chicago, 1968, taken from Elsa Knight Thompson's award-winning documentary, A Night in Chicago. Coverage like this was only possible with the advent of the portable recorder. It was this kind of reporting that brought back the experience of the protesters to homes across the country. And it was a marked departure from the traditional, static, distant reporting. It was to forever change the profession of being a journalist and change the experience of receiving the news. The 1960s were coming to a close. Nixon is in the White House. The violence which took place in Chicago that summer of 1968 would forever change conventions. The media coverage of the Democratic National Convention that summer, of the chaos both inside and out, would do great damage to the Democratic Party's image. The party leaders decided a new, less controversial method of choosing nominees was necessary, and a commission headed by George McGovern settled on the primary election. Since then, both parties rely on the system, and by the time each party convenes, there's no longer any mystery or suspense or any chance of controversy. A new age of conventions was to dawn in 1972 in Miami. Both the Republicans and Democrats will meet in that city, and there will be almost no excitement left inside the convention walls. Outside, on the streets of Miami, that is where the action will be. You're listening to A Passel of Pomp and a Circus of Circumstance, historic convention coverage from the Pacifica Radio Archives. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer, produced and edited by Christopher Sprinkle, written by Christopher Sprinkle and Mike Hodell, technical direction by Mark Torres. Pacifica producers who throughout the years produced the audio used in this documentary include Mike Hodell, Elsa Knight Thompson, Bill Watson, Gavin Duffy, Mad Dog Lebowski, Charles Bell, Jim Berlin, Kevin Stern, Amy Goodman, Jeremy Scahill, Larry Bensky, Samori Marksman, Tom Porter, Wendell Harper, and numerous other anonymous producers from Pacifica stations KPFA Berkeley, KPFK Los Angeles, WBAI New York, WPFW Washington, D.C., and KPFT Houston.